Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the News Gazette for Monday, April 20th. And we have a nice fresh spread for you this morning for Monday, starting with the top of the fold photo with the headline, Feeling Like a Champion. This is a large photo right over the top of the fold, with the caption, Illinois men's gymnast Brandon Dang accepts a first-place trophy after winning a national championship in the pommel horse Saturday night at the NCAA Men's Gymnastics Championships at State Farm Center in Champaign. The Illini finished fifth in the team standings, and that story, I think, will be later in the second half. For this half, we'll be covering local news, some local and state news, and then I'll be switching to sports and obituaries in the second half. So, and then we'll see how it goes after that. In the meantime, back to the front page here. Our first big story on the front of the News Gazette, of course, is the retirement of their very longtime photographer, Robin Schultz, and she's been with the paper for more than three decades. And I'm going to read that story here. And this is a Rob LaCate's name dropping column, right in the front. So let me begin with that. The headline first is: Photographic Paragon Retires After 35 Years with the News Gazette. And I'll begin. Robin Schultz may not resemble the Flash, besides the one atop her camera, but for the last 35 years, the News Gazette's photographic paragon gives Barry Allen a run for his money, being everywhere all at once. She has produced thousands of galleries and captured millions of images, and last Wednesday, Schultz bid adieu to the newsroom setting. She joked that her departure isn't exactly 35 years, but the two-week gap is minuscule, because she did enough overtime to make up for it and count for 35. Before college, Schultz had zero interest in photography. She grew up in Arlington Heights and went to Eastern Illinois University, originally studying pre-veterinary to take care of large animals. But science wasn't the fit for her. At a career day event, she connected with a journalism professor and convinced her to give writing a try, which didn't scratch that itch yet. So she tried photography, mainly because it was a required general education course, and she found where she belonged. The journalism coursework at Eastern is structured around involvement with student media outlets like the student-run newspaper. "We all got our training working at the Daily Eastern News," Schultz said. "That's where I learned everything, including the darkroom." She started photography in the film age, then transitioned to the digital age in the 1990s and 2000s. Schultz wasn't one to keep away from the chemicals when it came to image reproduction. There were ways to make prints better by using your fingers to make your whites come up if you rubbed it while it was in the developer, she said. She would front stain upon stains on her clothes, but found a solution to remove them. While the carcinogenic side effect helped get those silver splotches out of clothes, that risk led her away from it. During college, some of the memorable pictures she took included the university's 1980 run at the NCAA Division II football title, or when Rosalind Carter visited campus. She met Tom, her husband of 40 years, at Eastern, where both went to work as photojournalists after graduation. Her first job was with Lerner Newspapers in the Chicago region while waitressing for years. Then she was hired at the Waterloo Courier in Iowa. The newspaper underwent new ownership and gutted the photo department, letting everyone go on Friday, and then brought on Schultz the following Monday. "It was a good-sized paper, a small town, but a good-sized paper to cover," she said. "It was nice, and we enjoyed our time there." She stayed at the 1,000 circulation paper for 4 years before working with her husband at a chain of papers along U.S. 24 in central Illinois. After 3 years, she got the job at the News Gazette in Danville, in the Danville office, and eventually migrated to Champaign. She stayed with the News Gazette because she started her family in central Illinois, and it's a nice area, and I enjoy people I work with, she said. It was comfortable, and I didn't have to have the desire to go to a bigger paper. Schultz looks to celebrate her retirement by keeping busy in her flower garden and preparing for her first grandbaby, due in August. "I'm satisfied with what I've done here," she said. And that's the end of it, the end of the story. But there are some really nice photos of her time as a photographer, including a snapshot from the December 14th, 1980 edition of the Daily Eastern News, and with a football gallery that she shot. And there's an image here that she shares that got her the job at the News Gazette. And you can read more about that in the Monday paper here. Moving on the front page, our second story focuses on the Champaign City Council. And this is by Jana Wiersema, and the headline reads, "Public Input Sought on Plan to Address Homelessness." The City of Champaign is seeking the community's input on how to address the issue of homelessness. The city has posted a brief survey at engagechampaign.org/homelessness-prevention-blueprint. Questions include whether the respondent has ever experienced homelessness and which strategies they feel the city should prioritize. The survey is open until May 15th, and physical copies are available upon request at the city building. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, 23 out of every 10,000 people in the United States experienced homelessness in 2024, highlighting the national need to address this challenge, city officials said. In response, Champaign City Council has prioritized developing a blueprint for addressing housing needs and homelessness in our community. Survey results will help inform the city's homelessness prevention blueprint, which is intended to address housing instability and make homelessness rare, brief, and non-reoccurring. The city is also taking community data and best practices into consideration. One of the objectives in the current version of the plan is to explore the possibility of creating a multi-jurisdictional fund to support an emergency shelter with the purpose of creating a countywide year-round response managed by a third-party fiscal agent. I'm going to move on to some crime briefs here, a few pages into the paper. The first has the headline, "Two Sought in Theft of Clothes from Old Navy in Champaign." Champaign County Crime Stoppers is asking for the public's help identifying suspects in a clothing theft. At around 2 p.m. April 4th, two women entered Old Navy on North Neal Street in Champaign and walked throughout the store together. One selected a bag and concealed numerous items. On their way out, she grabbed two sweatshirts and wrapped them around the concealed clothing. As the women passed through the anti-theft machine to the exit, the clothing tags triggered alarms, both audibly and visually, and they made no attempt to stop and make payment. They left with over $500 in stolen merchandise. Police are seeking the public's assistance in identifying the suspects captured on the video. They were described as black women around 25 to 30 years old. The first was described as having a medium build and wearing a pink sweatshirt. The second was described as wearing all black clothing. They fled in a red four-door sedan. If you have information, contact Crime Stoppers at 217-373-8477. Or you can reach, go to 373tips.com or use your mobile app. And next we have a weather report here. Under our weather map section in the News Gazette, this is actually an Associated Press story, but focused on the Midwest, with the headline, "Powerful Winds Reported, Tornadoes Rip Through Midwest." A trail of damaged homes and buildings dotted a wide swath of the U.S. on Saturday after a burst of destructive winds and reported tornadoes tore off roofs, uprooted trees, and rendered rural roads impassable with debris. No deaths were reported following Friday's storms, which barreled through the upper Midwest and delivered the latest round of severe weather to batter the region. Officials braced residents for a long recovery in some rural communities. "We are extremely fortunate that this storm did not result in the loss of life or serious injury," Stevenson County Sheriff Steve Stovall said of the storm that hit Lena. Officials in Wisconsin and Minnesota echoed those sentiments. In central Wisconsin, a reported tornado that tore through the cities of Kronenwetter and Ringle left behind damaged homes and some residents briefly trapped in their basements. Ringle Fire Chief Chris Kielman told reporters. Marathon County Sheriff Chad Billab said he had not seen this much devastation during his 34 years in law enforcement. "A lot of people are going to need a lot of help," Billab said. In Kronenwetter, neighbors were helping each other clear debris from their properties, and Wisconsin Public Service was working to restore power. Police Chief Terry McHugh said it could be a lengthy process. He noted that the Community Foundation of North Central Wisconsin has partnered with United Way of Marathon County to help residents whose homes were damaged. In Olmsted County, Minnesota, sheriff's officials said tornadoes caused multiple levels of damage. At least 30 homes were damaged in Marion Township, with a number of those sustaining damage that was described as significant. Officials went door to door to check on people. The National Weather Service said the damage was likely caused by tornadoes, and surveys of the affected areas would be conducted over the weekend. On Friday in Illinois, Leo Zach, 14, had just gotten to the high school band room for a music competition when the building started shaking and the power went out. The room was packed with students, and some were very scared and had panic attacks. "I'm definitely on the luckier side of how that could have happened," he said. "I was just trying to stay calm, help other people." When they got outside, they found some of the windows blown out in the gym and part of the school's roof ripped off. Photos and video posted online showed a garage totaled, bricks torn from buildings, and fences demolished. Lena is a village of nearly 3,000 people, located about 117 miles northwest of Chicago. Rachel Neiman was going to pick up her stepson from Lena's middle school when she had to pull into a car wash to take cover from the storm. She watched a large tree get ripped from the ground and sparks fly feet in front of her. "This is something that you see online, not in real life, especially in a small town in Illinois," she said. And moving on, I'm going to cover about one business story and one a column by Jim Dye this morning. We'll start with an Associated Press story with the headline, "Starting today, businesses can claim refunds for Trump tariffs declared unconstitutional." A refund system for businesses that paid tariffs, which the U.S. Supreme Court ruled President Donald Trump imposed without the constitutional authority to do so, is scheduled to launch today. Importers and their brokers will be able to begin claiming refunds through an online portal beginning at 8 a.m., according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the agency administering the system. It's the first step in a complicated process that also might eventually lead to refunds for consumers who were billed for some or all of the tariffs on products shipped to them from outside the United States. Companies must submit declarations listing the goods on which they collectively put billions of dollars toward the import taxes the court subsequently struck down. If CBP approves the claim, it will take 60 to 90 days for a refund to be issued, the agency said. The government expects to process refunds in phases, however, focusing first on more recent tariff payments. Any number of technical factors and procedural issues could delay an importer's application, so any reimbursements businesses plan to make to customers likely would trickle down slowly. In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court on February 20th found that Trump usurped Congress's tax-setting role last April when he set new import tax rates on products from almost every other country, citing the U.S. trade deficit as a national emergency that warranted his invoking of a 1977 emergency powers law. Although the court majority did not address refunds in its ruling, a judge at the U.S. Court of International Trade determined last month that companies subjected to IEEPA tariffs were entitled to money back. Not all tax imports are immediately eligible. Customs and Border Protection said in court filings that over 330,000 importers paid a total of about $166 billion over 53 million shipments. Not All of these orders qualify for the first phase of the refund system's rollout, which is limited to cases in which tariffs were estimated but not finalized or within 80 days of a final accounting. To receive refunds, importers have to register for the CPB's electronic payment system. As of April 14th, 56,497 importers had completed registration and were eligible for refunds totaling $127 billion, including interest, the agency said. System requires, that's a subhead there. Megan Supino, a partner at Ice Miller, said the law firm has advised clients to carefully list in their declarations all of the document numbers for forms that went to CBP to describe imported goods and their value. If there's an entry on that file that does not qualify, it may cause the entire entry to be rejected, or that line item might be rejected by Customs, she said. Supino thinks the portal going live will require composure as well as diligence. Like any electronic online program that goes live with a lot of interest, I would expect that there might be some hiccups with the program on Monday, she said. So we continue to ask everyone to be patient because we think that patience will pay off. Nagi Huyen, the partner in charge of transfer pricing at accounting and consulting firm Armanino said that most companies claiming refunds will have imported a mix of items and not all will qualify right away. It's about having a clear process in place and keeping track of what's been submitted and what's been paid so nothing falls through the cracks, she said. Each file can include thousands of entries, but accuracy is critical as submissions can be rejected if formatting or data is incorrect. And I'm going to move on to an opinion piece by Jim Dye. This is focused on sports betting. The headline reads, Pritzker's wager on a sports betting tax paying off so far. And here I'll begin. Losing bet? Are Governor J.B. Pritzker's tax hikes on sports wagering creating a potential problem for the state? On one hand, the answer is no. The Illinois Gaming Board reports the state's sports handle for February was $1.17 billion, an increase of 1.5% over February 2025. On the other hand, while the sports handle went up, the number of people placing bets declined big time. The state's 10 sports books in February accepted 20.6 million wagers, down 25% from February 2025. Desperate for new revenue, Pritzker and legislators passed the 2025-26 budget, which included a new per-wager tax on online sports books. The state charges 25 cents on each of the first 20 million online bets and 50 cents per bet thereafter. The governor estimated it would raise more than $36 million. The industry considers the tax to be an albatross on its back, and friendly legislators are seeking to repeal it. But that legislation will go nowhere as long as the state remains in dire financial straits. Illinois ranks high among states where sports wagering is legal. The February report shows Illinois trailed only New York in the size of its sports handle. New York's handle exceeded $2 billion, while Illinois' was $1.17 billion. Eight other states reported numbers ranging from $515 million in Maryland to $846 million in New Jersey. Industry taxation concerns stem from the fear that those wagering on sports will go outside of Illinois to place their bets or use the illegal market. But state officials have dismissed those concerns. Pritzker proposed roughly $600 million in tax hikes in his recent 2026-27 budget proposal. It includes increasing the tax rate on table games at casinos outside Chicago from the current 15% to 20% to 50%. The governor estimated it would raise an additional $120 million. A federal education scholarship program is popular with voters, at least if it results from the March primary election meaning anything. The federal education scholarship program. The Illinois Policy Institute reports that 64% of voters in 33 jurisdictions support the state opting into the federal scholarship tax program. The proposal was included in recent federal tax legislation. So far, states that tend to vote Republican have shown much more enthusiasm to participate than those that tend to vote Democrat. Pritzker, a Democrat, has said he's not made up his mind whether to support the proposal, but it's vehemently opposed by teachers' unions who have great influence on the governor's decisions. The program allows taxpayers to donate to eligible K-12 scholarship-granting organizations in exchange for a federal tax credit up to $1,700, IPI said. The organizations then provide scholarship money to eligible K-12 students. It operates along the same lines as the now-defunct Illinois Invest in Kids program that Pritzker and supermajority Democrats terminated. Under the federal law, Illinois taxpayers still can get the tax credit even if the state doesn't opt in, but their donations will go to children in other states. And now we have a third topic here with the small subhead, New Boss, Same as Old Boss. John Holasek played football at the University of Illinois, not musical chairs, but he has adopted the latter game as the on-again, off-again, and back-on-again head coach at Loyola Academy in the Chicago area. The record-setting head coach stepped down in 2022 after 17 seasons in which his teams won 185 games and three state championships. He's been a team assistant coach for the last 3 years under Bo Derashow, who will take on new duties as the team's general manager and work as an assistant for Holasek. According to news accounts, Derashow won 30 games and two state titles in his 3 seasons as Ramblers head coach. Derashow said he's grateful to continue serving Loyola in this new role and to work alongside John and our staff. Holasek, who is 53, was a star linebacker at Marion Catholic High School in the South Suburbs before coming to the University of Illinois. An all-Big Ten player, he was one of the murderous H-boys linebackers along with Kevin Hardy and Dana Howard. He played at the U of I from 1990 to 1994. Drafted by the Buffalo Bills, he spent 8 seasons in the NFL. And speaking of football, former Northwestern football coach Pat Fitzgerald has settled into the top job at Michigan State after a 3-year exile. To say he's tanned, rested, and ready is an understatement. He's full of fire. I feel like Andy Dufresne in Shawshank Redemption. I crawled all the way through the excrement and came out cleaner on the other side, he told USA Today. Fitzgerald is referring to the 2023 hazing scandal at Northwestern, one where older players abused and humiliated younger ones. Northwestern's mishandling of the situation from a public relations standpoint was so outrageously bad that it generated an angry backlash among the media and the public. In response, the school fired Fitzgerald, even though there was no evidence he knew about the hazing. He filed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against Northwestern and ultimately negotiated a substantial out-of-court settlement to pay off his long-term contract. In his free time, he volunteered as an assistant at a local high school. While he signed a non-disparagement clause in his settlement, it's obvious Fitzgerald remains angry about what happened. I was treated like a criminal, he said, recalling how he and his wife quietly visited his old office to retrieve personal belongings. He said he never got a chance to say goodbye to the janitorial staff, you know, to our great chefs and cooks, to our equipment people, to the staff, he said. Recalling his wife's tears as they drove away with his personal property, Fitzgerald said, I looked at her and said, when we pull on to Sheridan Road, I want you to stop crying because this is over. We're moving on. Just 51, Fitzgerald has welcomed 40-plus new players to the MSU roster and is raring to go. I said this to the players in our first meeting. You didn't choose me. I chose here. You're going to get a guy who's going to pour everything he's got into you. And here's an author's corner. This spot is where Jim's pseudo-intellectual book club occasionally recommends books News Gazette readers might find interesting. But it's time for a different approach, recommending authors who've written multiple winners. Jonathan Eig and Winston Groom. Eig has written Luckiest Man, The Life and Death of Lou Gehrig, Opening Day, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Season, Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster, The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution, and Ali, A Life. His most recent triumph is King, A Life, an autobiography of Martin Luther King that is perceived as the number one King biography. It is a masterpiece. Also top-notch are Ali, a great bio of Muhammad Ali, and Opening Day, the story of Jackie Robinson's first season. Both concern sports, but are loaded with terrific social history. Indeed, it's hard to imagine an Ige book that wouldn't hold a reader's interest. Groom, who died in 2020, is perhaps best known as the author of Forrest Gump. It was made into a hit movie starring Tom Hanks. The pseudo-intellectual can't vouch for his fiction writing. His histories have been excellent. He combines multiple historical characters into one story that follows their interactions in great moments. Hence, The Generals, stories of George Patton, Douglas MacArthur, and George Marshall during World War II, and The Allies, a similar study of Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin. He produced a volume on the epic age of flight with the aviators, which examined the life and times of Charles Lindbergh, Eddie Rickenbacker, and Jimmy Doolittle. His histories run the gamut, everything from the Civil War through World War II. Those who like history and are looking for something to pique their interests ought to check out both of these literary masters. And that's the end of Jim Dye's column. I'm going to move on to a little bit of national news here. We have, looks like a story from Wisconsin, 25 arrested in clashes at Beagle breeding facility. This is an Associated Press story. Around 25 protesters were arrested as around 1,000 animal welfare activists tried to gain early entry into a beagle breeding and research facility in Wisconsin and were met by officers firing pepper spray and rubber bullets, authorities said Sunday. Saturday's protest was the second attempt in as many months by demonstrators to take beagles from Ridgeland Farms in Blue Mounds, about 25 miles southwest of the capital, Madison. They were turned back by officers who arrested the group's leader. The Dane County Sheriff's Office said the situation was significantly calmer and more peaceful on Sunday when around 200 people assembled outside the farm. They dispersed after around 2 hours, it said. We're pleased with the group's cooperation today and their willingness to remain peaceful while still sending their message of concern for the dogs at Ridgeland Farms, Sheriff Calvin Barrett said in a statement. We're happy to support anyone who wants to exercise the right to protest, as long as they do so lawfully. The sheriff had said in a video statement Saturday that 300 to 400 protesters were violently trying to break into the property. They tried to overcome barricades that included a manure-filled trench, hay bales, and a barbed wire fence. Some got through the fence but were unable to enter the facility, where an estimated 2,000 beagles are kept, the Wisconsin State Journal reported. Those arrested included the leader of the Coalition to Save the Ridgeland Dogs, Wayne Hussing, 44, of New York, who was being held on a tentative felony charge of conspiracy to commit burglary. But most arrestees were just booked and released, the sheriff's office said Sunday. No one should be assaulted for giving aid to a dog, even if damage to property is part of that rescue effort, Singh said in a statement from jail Sunday that also accused authorities of using excessive force. The animals of this earth are not things. They are sentient beings, and we have the right to rescue them from abuse, he concluded. Protesters took 30 dogs when they broke into the facility in March, when authorities arrested 27 people. Ridgeland denies mistreating animals, but agreed in October to give up its state breeding license as of July 1st in a deal to avoid prosecution on animal mistreatment charges. On its website, the company says no credible evidence of animal abuse, cruelty, mistreatment, or neglect at Ridgeland Farms has ever been presented or substantiated. And I'm going to take a short break now and return with the second half of the News Gazette for Monday, April 20th, shortly. Please stay tuned.